Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau.
And we got some feedback. Always great. Excited as usual. A big shout out to No Clue for commenting on our Apocalypse World episode.
And he chose that name.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't choose the names for the people who comment.
Shout out to
Hey, we got a comment from Poor Grammar.
Yeah, we respectfully disagree with you. Sorry, go on. No Clue posted some stuff about Apocalypse World.
Yes, he did. And he just posted that, you know, the sort of the same thing happened in his game. You know, it was kind of difficult to be MC, and, you know, things can fall apart if basically people aren't on the same page, and offered some advice about, you know, how to sort of ask questions to make sure that everyone's on the same page and that character creation goes smoothly.
Yeah, actually, I sent a couple of emails back and forth with him, and he had some pretty good advice. I wish we'd have talked to him before we actually started up the game.
Well, I listened to some other, like, actual play podcasts, and yeah, it was the same thing. I was like, yeah, if I had listened to these before we actually tried to play the game, I think things would have gone better. But yeah, you try things and you fail, and you learn from them, hopefully.
You never do them again.
Yeah.
That's what I learned from that experience.
Yeah, I figured that. Like, oh, Lau, want to play Apocalypse again? Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Wow.
It'll be better, yeah.
Yeah, not very hard to make it better.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, but the stuff we learned did help out with a Monster Hearts campaign that we're running now, hey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of the other people I've been interacting with on Twitter, both Temujin and Jimbo Hawkins, we got some really positive feedback on our ships episode. Jimbo Hawkins has decided to actually use ships in his campaign because of hearing the episode.
That's good. Didn't they have some advice as well? Like some stuff that we actually probably should have included in the episode.
Ah, yes. Both of them suggested talking about cursed ships.
Flying Dutchman?
Yep. Yep. And the Mary Celeste. You kind of look at that and you're like, yeah, why didn't we come up with that?
Yeah. Mary Celeste wasn't cursed, eh?
I guess it wasn't cursed, but it was one of those very much like Roanoke. It was one of those things, like it was just found completely abandoned of all hands with like food still on the table and all the rations there and literally no explanation to where the crew went and why it was completely empty.
You know they had an explanation.
I didn't know same that. I don't, spoiler, I don't want to know.
Okay. And same with Roanoke.
All right, spoiler.
Like these great mysteries that actually aren't really mysteries.
Does that make the mystery less great?
Yeah.
I disagree anyway.
The mystery of life, although man and woman get together. Oh.
Well, mystery of life is 42.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that the secret?
No, that's the answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything.
All right.
There you go.
God.
Get it right, nerd.
I do like the idea, though, of cursed ships, and we've been playing around with the idea of doing something about curses.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe for Halloween?
That would be applicable. Yeah.
Well, I guess one of the good things about you not having to work with Lyle, Chris, is you don't have to suffer through his giant man crush on Joseph Mangalia, the guy who plays El Cid in True Blood. Always at lunch, Lyle's like, oh, man, and look at how big he is, and like shows me photos on his phone. I'm like, this is kind of weird. Oh.
He's a big man.
He's a big man. I mean, he has to be constantly reminding me of how big he is and showing me shirtless pictures of him.
He should have been Superman.
Though in your defense, I think I looked up True Blood the other day and I saw a few of his pictures. I don't think I saw a single picture with him with a shirt on. So
there you go. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, well, what pictures am I going to show?
Yeah, but Chris, did you download it as wallpaper for your phone?
I'm exercising.
Yeah, inspiration. You're like, I'm going to get big and buff just like him and then he'll like me.
I just got to get big enough. I hear he doesn't like guys too muscly.
Oh, jeez.
Anyway, but True Blood Season 5 is pretty good. I was just trying to change the subject.
I know.
Well, why don't we change the subject to the actual topic? And that is the next in our literature lessons. And we're going to look at scientific romance, which would be the science fiction of people like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells with a dash of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Basically the early days of science fiction.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at it as a genre. and we've picked out some certain elements, and we've actually put them as little combos. So some of these combos we put together because they sound nice together. So whether or not it
actually works.
Works. Well, we'll see. Or maybe you won't see because we'll cut it out. All right. Well, there's a lot of elements in the scientific romance. And the first one we'd like to talk about is explorations and exoticism and how that comes up. And I guess a similar genre or a connected genre, planetary romance, is also all about that. And I guess we'd be thinking of things like Burroughs is A Princess of Mars. I got to say, I prefer Tarzan.
Yeah, you've said that. Yeah. Which I've never actually read a Tarzan
I've got him.
Story, so I probably should.
Yeah.
I think I've read most of the John Carter Mars stuff, though.
Oh, okay.
I was going to say, the whole point of like exoticism and exploration, this is kind of like the big theme for me with this early sci-fi stuff because of sort of what was happening in the world when the kind of like early science fiction was written.
Which would be the latter half of the 19th century.
Yes. Yes.
We're going to end it around Buck Rogers, which is about 1928 when that first came out.
Yeah.
So we would say that's just before the golden age of science fiction, which would be the 1930s. Yeah, pretty interrupt.
We should have
done that before.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah. Thank you for interrupting us. That's a good point. But kind of like towards the beginning when this was happening, like people were getting information about other cultures and other people and other places that they wouldn't have gotten before because of sort of the expansion of colonial empires. And these kind of like the early science fiction novels were a way for people to kind of explore those places without actually going there, because even though people were going there, travel for the average citizen was still pretty difficult or expensive, and it was just easier to read these novels and kind of live vicariously through the protagonists in them. So I think that's kind of why exploration and the idea that there are still these sort of blank spaces on the map was really important. And that kind of transferred over to the exploration of other planets, other times, and other dimensions even.
Yeah, I always found quite interesting about those stories the classic is Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Right.
You know, just the fact that there's like kind of the Hollow Earth. Wow, hey, your favorite game there.
Yeah.
Hollow Earth Expedition. And then Torg had A Land Below. It was kind of that idea where it's very real pulp, but a lot of dinosaurs.
And it was below something, right?
Yeah, it was below our land. Yeah.
It's more like a concentric Earth.
Yeah. Not very original namers. Yeah. But, yeah, I think that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the land above a lot of times, except like the mushrooms are bigger.
Yeah. Well, I saw it in a little bit different way than you, Wayne, in that this was kind of the closing part of the colonial period. It was more where it was less government's expansion around the globe, but it was more businesses' expansion around the globe. So it was kind of regular people, I think, for the first time, were to have contact with different places around the world, because there were catalogs coming out, for example, in Britain that allowed you to order teas from China and from India. And it was the first time that people in Europe would have access to things from the rest of the world, at least on a regular basis. So I think kind of that experience, the world opening up to them, showing them what was possible, I think that's what really helped the boom out, rather than kind of the colonial parts, which was a little bit earlier in history. But that's just my opinion.
Fair enough, but don't those kind of go in hand to hand?
Absolutely, absolutely. But I think that the government expansion, the colonial thing, that was more, I think that wasn't with the people so much as like later on when the businesses started moving, like the Dutch East Indies Company, that it kind of brought it to more down to a commoner's level.
I guess I saw it more as, you know, the colonial expansion happened because of, you know, invasion, which will come up later, but armies would go out and take these places, and that means, you know, a certain subset of people would have actually gone to these places or experienced these places, and, you know, people would come home, and not all of them were authors, but these kind of stories would be told. So, after saying that, I don't really think you can say one or the other was, you know, the major cause of this, but...
But I think both had a very important role in bringing it about.
Yeah, sure, I guess I saw exploration, too, as... I guess tied a little bit closer to government expansion, because at least soldiers actually had to go out and explore these places, which is what is the exciting part of sort of the early sci-fi, in my opinion.
There were a lot of war veterans in these stories.
Yeah.
John Carter is one. Buck Rogers is one.
Yeah, you see a lot of these people, as you said, ex-soldiers or current soldiers. I mean, think of Watson from Sherlock Holmes, right?
Yep.
He's a veteran coming back, and even though we don't
Science fiction, but yeah.
I know, but as an example of sort of the war veteran character to tell these stories, even though we don't really hear any of Watson's stories that aren't about Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
But.
Do you think a lot of it or any of it was a reaction to the Industrial Revolution as well?
Well, just to touch on, I was like, as soon as you said that, I was like, where have I heard that before? Oh, our magic episode.
Yes.
Yeah, when people are tired of having things explained to them, so in the magic episode, we propose the idea that some of these magic societies were a reaction to that. I think you're both right. You're both pretty.
Thank you, Lyle.
In that, yeah, I mean, I actually was hearing about this guy called Thomas Friedman, and he wrote this thing called this book called The World is Flat, and he was saying like kind of things went into three big waves, like countries exploring or interacting, and then it went to like companies, and now it's in individuals. And I think, you know, and people are saying, oh, that's a pretty revolutionary concept of an explanation of what's happened in the world. But you could look in the 19th century as, yeah, they're still at the stage where the countries are doing all the interacting, all the exploring, all the expanding, with some exceptions of some companies, like the Dutch West Indies Company, Hudson Bay Company. But, you know, you just want to think of what's manageable as an individual. So in these stories, it's those like little scientific teams, and they go out and they do great things. You know, they make the big discoveries. Yeah, and I think that's, yeah, you can imagine you're part of that team. It's easier to transport yourself.
I think that's probably why stories like that took off, because the reader, it's much easier for the reader to imagine themselves as that character than if the sort of protagonist of a book was kind of a faceless company.
But that said, a lot of some of the H.G. Wells protagonists were pretty faceless.
Mm, yeah.
It was all about the concepts, but he was a bit more, I don't want to say cerebral, but he was a bit more political than somebody like Jules Verne.
I was going to say preachy.
Okay.
Preachy. Yeah, but sometimes like that facelessness can help you see yourself as that character even more, because if sort of the character or the personality of the main character in a story isn't defined by the author, you know, the reader can put themselves in those shoes much more easily, which I read is why the Twilight books did so well among the people they were aimed at.
Oh, why's that?
Because the main character is described in a very, very, almost exceptionally minimalist way, where it was easier for the young girl readers to identify or to put themselves in the place of Bella.
Oh, okay.
She almost had like no personality. Nothing was written about her.
Oh, so I see Kristen Stewart's really captured that.
Burn.
I haven't seen the movies.
Don't need to.
Yeah. Mm. I do think she's pretty, though.
It's still going to make up for that True Blood guy.
one little line doesn't undo, like, a week's worth of gushing.
If I meet him, I'm going to ask him to hold me in his arms. I'm going to take a picture. I'll try to make it look, like, totally cool, like two guys.
No, you're going to be like, wait, no, kneel down, so we're at the same height level. Wait, I want both our faces in the shot.
Anyway, so exoticism?
Again, I think this ties very closely with exploration and the idea you were getting kind of these stories coming back from cultures that hadn't been experienced by sort of what I'll call mainstream culture, for lack of a better term. And it's kind of unavoidable that those stories would be exaggerated, sort of, what's another word I'm looking for? Fancifulized isn't a word. Not a word.
Yeah. What's the word I'm creating right now?
Fantastic.
Maybe what I'm looking for is sensationalized.
Yeah, at the time, if you imagine like half the world was Papua New Guinea or Indonesia, and Yeah, because a lot of the stories, like Lost World, or Journey to the Center of the Earth, some of it, they're almost like they're going back into time, but not. It's not time travel. They're kind of like going to these places where time stood still. And that was a form of exoticism. Even when you go like John Carter from Mars, the society is a throwback. I mean, sometimes they'll have pretty decent technology, sometimes they won't. But the political organization, at least when we're talking about these type, like the ones that focus on the exoticism and exploration, like it's, you know, their monarchies and things like that.
Yeah, one of the things I read that kind of even though we're not really talking specifically about Sword and Planet, kind of the space opera or the space exploration sort of genre grew out of those kind of Lost World pulp and sort of romance novels, because sort of what's the next step? Okay, we've kind of, you know, you get to a certain point and you feel like, okay, we've done everything. You know, we've kind of had enough stories about Africa or South America or these real world places. What's the next step is to, you know, go off world, either down into the hollow earth or off onto one of these real planets. And so sort of the alien cultures sort of took the place of the, you know, the noble savage, or kind of the sort of backwards government or feudal monarchy that these old sort of pulp Lost World stories used. So it's almost kind of like a direct translation, you know? Like an example of that is, as we said before, kind of like the John Carter series, the Barsoom series. I mean, you look at the Green Men of Mars, and they have sort of like a tribal structure. They're very kind of savage. And you can pretty clearly see how they're influenced, or almost an analog for Native American or African tribesmen, sort of as they would be seen during this time period.
In some stories, even just had like Native Americans, like Lost World. There's like they're fighting like these ape-like creatures.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Apes were big.
Savage. Yeah.
Apes just never went out of style.
Yeah, literally.
You would be really happy if you found like an early sci-fi work that like talks about the horrors of chimpanzees, wouldn't you?
Well, a lot, you know. It's good that they recognized that even back then.
See, even back then they knew how evil chimps were.
Yeah. They were warning us, actually. They're so prophetic.
Heed their warning.
Now, on the opposite, I mean, when they scale down, like, the politics, you know, kind of make it to enhance the exoticism, sometimes they'll use the stories as a critique of the current political system. H.G. Wells is big into that.
Right.
Preachy as a... So, and our next point is colonialism and Marxism. So Wayne talked about kind of the positive side of colonialism, or what we call like exploration. But yeah, there's certainly a downside, all that exploitation.
Yeah.
Little trade-off.
Hey, if you're the colonial power,
no.
Not much of a downside.
Yeah, there's a lot of upside.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like certain like political ideas were coming into vogue, such as Marxism. And a good example is like the time machine, where he starts going into the future, and you see what, you know, we start to see dystopian novels come into play, often as a critique. What do they say? Chris, we were talking about it before. Oh, mm-hmm. Jules Verne versus H.G. Wells. And Jules Verne used, we talk about the tech a lot. And but for H.G. Wells, it was the tech, like even the time machine doesn't describe it very much. It's just a vehicle to get to the kind of where he thinks politics could go, or his critiques of politics.
Did you actually want Chris to say that point?
Yeah. What were you saying, Chris?
I said that for you.
Right?
Yeah, pretty well summed up. Good job.
But it's kind of interesting what you said about sort of this is kind of the sort of beginning of when we see like dystopian future things, because that that unpublished Jules Verne work, what, Paris in the 20th Century, mm-hmm. So the last one he wrote, was very dystopian. It ends very depressingly. Spoilers. And that's part of the reason why it was not published, because his publicist said, don't publish it.
I think it's publisher.
Oh, publisher. Yeah. Sorry. Said, yeah. Okay. Publisher said, don't publish it. You know, it's kind of too dark, too dystopian. So.
No. I don't think that ever went out of style. I mean, we talk about it being scientific romance, but yeah, science fiction certainly hung on to that, speculating what where society will continue to grow. But I think for the most part, I mean, there was some pessimism, but a lot of it was pretty optimistic of where things will go. I just think it'd be easier and easier.
But I mean, I think that kind of comes from the time when, you know, these works were written. You know, technology was progressing, things were getting better for at least some of the population, probably the ones that would be reading this literature. So when you're kind of at the start of what I'll call like a slope, you know, kind of this technological progression, I think it's very easy to extrapolate things up in a positive way, you know, where maybe if you're, you know, closer to the top, you can say, well, we don't really know where this is going to go. There isn't much more place to go, and it's maybe easier to be more pessimistic about it. So
I would say, yeah, the periods of uncertainty. Yeah, I guess that's a good metaphor. You know, they're at the bottom of a slope or they're at the top of the slope. They don't know. And, you know, that, I think those are the times when you see like a real explosion of real quality science fiction. You saw some stuff in the 30s and 40s when technology continued to grow and society was making a big shift towards a more socialist way. 60s, when there was a lot of cultural stuff. Mm. So there's a big explosion there. Just something to take from your game. And what they call like alternative history, where they pick a point in history and then they go, okay, this is how society changed. It's to point those, pick out those periods of uncertainty. And then I think you can really spin an interesting science fiction world or scientific romantic world.
Sorry, just to clarify, when you say sort of pick out the parts of uncertainty.
So the beginning of something like the Industrial Revolution. Yeah, when it started and people were really uncertain of, is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? You know, because it was, yeah, it was good for, I wouldn't say it was good for a lot of people.
Hmm.
Certainly changed things
right.
For a lot of people or for everyone. Yeah, but those are the times you really can't predict what's going to happen.
Hmm.
So that I think that gives you as a storyteller, a game master, the most freedom.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah, you really can't be wrong. Sure, history went this way, but it could have went a myriad of other ways.
That's also to say, you know, that there's a lot of latitude within these stories. I mean, even if you go something like the Industrial Revolution and speculating on maybe, I don't know, steampunk technology or something like that, you can go all the way up to the aristocracy who have it fantastic, all of these machines working out for them, or you could go a dystopian route with it, and people who are stuck, you know, down stamping out rivets for the newest clank machines.
Or both at the same time, because that's kind of what happened.
And in a sense, like in these scientific romances, is that you can roll back certain things if you're going to play this kind of game. Maybe the technology is different. I hesitate to say more advanced because we certainly went in a different direction with the information technology. But you can also roll back certain social things because definitely that didn't seem terribly advanced in these stories. You still had white male protagonists. You still had a very strict hierarchy. A lot of those, they go to these worlds of Mars and Venus and they were similar, but yeah, like I think like Chris said, there's still like some sort of aristocracy. It was hard for people to imagine that that would ever go away.
Actually, yeah, it's an interesting point, like especially with H.G. Wells, you know, there are some things that the authors could really see past. For example, H.G. Wells was very critical of the aristocracy and the stratification of British life. But on the other hand, he didn't really get past race at all. And he was a heavy believer in eugenics, the superiority of the white man. So it's interesting, some things that kind of can move on and some things that just don't.
Yeah, certainly.
I'd like to talk a little bit and more about eugenics. So can we move on to the next topic of xenophobia and invasion, which was a massive theme around this time. And just to talk, like when Chris says about eugenics, but the way we're talking about eugenics is as, whoa, that was so silly. That would, you know, that's such an antiquated idea. But eugenics was like new stuff at that time. You know, people like H.G. Wells, if they're, maybe they're justifying their racism or whatever, but they're like, look what science is telling me. And that's another thing about the scientific revolution. Maybe that's a whole theme of itself, is that there's a lot of trust in science. I mean, right now we're living in a time when people are doubting climate change and evolution. This is in the States, maybe.
I get my mouth shut. That's a whole other topic.
Yeah. But at this time, it's just like, yeah, science can explain everything. And science can explain my racism. Hey, it's not racism, it's eugenics.
Mm. Yeah. Not to go back to a previous point, but I think that ties in, again, with the Industrial Revolution, where, hey, you know, technology is doing all these great things, and science has made that happen. So why wouldn't we believe what science is telling us to be true? You know, like you said, people have a lot of faith in it. It's kind of like, well, you know, it hasn't been proven to be wrong yet. And I think at that point, science wasn't totally, but was still very much about what people could observe. And, you know, you can only observe so much if you don't have the correct tools for it.
Probably you write a science fiction novel now, you might be looking at how certain technological advancements would corrupt society or disrupt society or destroy the individual. But at that time, you know, even like somebody like Verne's, who's imagining all these like scientific advancements and predicting them, primarily they weren't looking at how it would actually hurt society. It was all about how it benefited. When H.G. Wells is talking about the grim stuff, he wasn't necessarily talking about how the technology was making it bad, but just how like the politics or how one race devolved and the other race kind of advanced a bit, and that kind of like, you know, time machine. Mm. And the relationship that they had with these like Morlocks, these workers.
Yeah,
doing the research for this episode, we found out that at the time, like when H.G. Wells is writing things like War of the Worlds, there was a, what was it called, the invasion genre. Like, I guess the seminal work was a thing called The Battle of Dorking. Yeah, I always have to double check my notes. Is it Dorking? Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was the invasion of Britain, and the British Empire got dismantled.
Hmm.
So it went from like 1871 to 1914, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah, it was around there, yeah.
Yeah, and it was popular in the countries that eventually became the main antagonists of World War One, like Germany, England, France.
Hmm.
Go figure. Yeah, it's interesting. I actually never heard of it myself, this invasion literature as well. It was apparently pretty popular in Japan, too, again, with the whole World War II thing.
World War One.
Oh, World War One. Thank you, yes.
This might be a tangent, but maybe part of the reason we, as modern people, perhaps didn't realize it was so popular is because only like the best examples of art or literature from a certain time period survive to the present day. Because like you think about it, okay, War of the Worlds, pretty much everybody knows about War of the Worlds. But then when we were doing the research on invasion literature, it's like, no, there are a lot of people writing this fiction for about like 400 titles that we don't really know about, probably because they weren't very good. And only the War of the Worlds kind of survived to become a classic.
Yeah, apparently War of the Worlds shares a lot of similarities with the Battle of Dorking. So that would be, you know, maybe at the time could have been considered a derivative work.
Hmm.
They say Dracula was kind of rode the wave of this invasion fiction.
Really?
Incorporated some elements. Well, he's a foreigner.
Hmm, yeah.
And he invades. Yeah, I think you know where I'm going here.
Yep.
Yeah. He's different.
Yeah.
And of course, it's always like some sort of, I think the scariest ones were like the Great Unwashed or the Hordes, the Pan-Asians. Yeah. Mm. And we look at like Flash Gordon and the main villain, Ming the Merciless.
Right.
And of course, you would think back to like China or Mongolia or whatever, and kind of that fear that it raises. But that's exciting. You're reading these and it's like, yes, you know, beat him back, blonde polo player from Yale. That's right. You show him what eugenics is all about.
Yeah. But I guess I can kind of understand where that or why those would be the antagonist, because, again, tying back to colonialism, wouldn't kind of the biggest fear be, hey, these people that were kind of invading or helping? Because, I mean, I guess you could argue that certain people would say, no, we're bringing culture to these people. But wouldn't the fear of the time be the rejection of that and these sort of people uprising and invading your quote-unquote perfect society?
Yeah.
So I could see why the horde or the unwashed masses or the like exotic invader would be the logical antagonist in these stories.
Yeah, or like even the time machine is a little bit different.
Mm.
But that must have been chilling when they read the kind of the relationship that the upper and the lower castes had with each other.
Yeah, it's like a political commentary when you look at it now.
Yeah.
And I could see sort of both sides of that coin. You know, the colonial powers could see themselves as the Eloi. And wouldn't it be terrifying if these savage Morlocks came and disrupted their perfect society that has no war or no violence or anything? But then on the other hand, the political commentary is, no, you used to be one people and things got so bad that you split. And now look at what the Morlocks are subjected to and what they have to live in.
Yeah.
So movie didn't capture that very well. The newer one, sorry.
Oh, Guy Pearce?
Yeah, it was kind of a crappy movie.
Yeah, it's a shame what it did to his career.
Yeah.
Well, he's a much better actor than that.
Hmm.
Yeah, no, but I think that is, that's something that can, we talk about some other elements, you know, where you roll back society, our concept of society, where you've got like kind of an aristocracy, but just that, you got to have that iceberg or that mass underneath, that pulsing mass that could just flip everything at any time.
Hmm.
Yeah, when things invade, they don't invade equally. They either overwhelm you in numbers or they overwhelm you in technology, but nothing's equal.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that was what kind of interesting about War of the Worlds. They don't really have a chance, although they were able to like take down one of the Martians.
Right.
But it was just like they were just going to get overwhelmed. Hmm. And there was no chance in this invasion story. And I doubt if anybody's going to dig up the Battle of Dorking. So, yeah, Britain loses, you know. These are like the horror books of the 19th century.
Yeah. And I guess, as you said before, about like the sort of stratified social classes of society at the time, you talking about like the iceberg and this like pulsing mass underneath it, as opposed to like an outside invader, wouldn't it also be scary if the lower classes, quote unquote, invaded, you know, the upper classes and just decided we're sort of not going to take this anymore and, again, destroy that perfect society that the upper levels of society have created for themselves?
They are the 99%.
Yeah, exactly.
Just when you said that, I mean, a lot of times in the predictions, when you read like Ladies' Home Journal, I think that had a famous issue around 19...
the future.
Yeah, they predicted the future, like 100 years in the future. I think it came out in 1900.
Did they predict that women would have all this like freedom?
I can't remember. They predicted like giant tomatoes and strawberries.
Mm.
Yeah.
As the invaders?
Taking over!
sorry, go ahead.
I think they actually predicted our average height correctly. They said we would grow a couple of inches, and we actually grew a couple of inches in 100 years.
But they also predicted we would keep growing, and that's why we would need the giant tomatoes.
I'm not going to let that go.
No, I'm not.
That's awesome.
Sorry.
But, I mean, when they do predict this technology, a lot of times they aren't making a commentary. Like, they just focus on the technology, and it's a benefit to all mankind. But you could do it where it doesn't. It actually just further and further stratifies, or what Chris is talking about, like the 1% and the 99%, and you continue to go into opposite directions, yeah.
Yeah, and you end up with the time machine.
Well, they had the noble savage, and I guess what you could almost do with the ignoble savage, the ones that they don't like, the ones that were Americans and Canadians before, but now they've just evolved into something less than.
Like, I've brought it up before, but that was kind of one of the other things that was sort of interesting about that post-apocalyptic game, Degenesis, because sort of Africa was the only country that sort of survived unscathed by this apocalypse, and the European countries essentially reverted to a state of barbarism while Africa still had technology. So it was almost, and then Africa did the invading to collect slaves and resources. And it was kind of an interesting flip of the sort of colonial era setup.
Oh, but Africa had slavery before.
I'm sorry, I wasn't saying that they didn't. I'm just saying they were the ones doing the invading rather than the other way around.
You know, it'd be fun for a game to do like a sci-fi one where it's, say, 100 years in the future where some other area of the world, maybe Asia or Africa, has advanced and they kind of have this really good equality and technological system, but the rest of the world is maybe trapped the current time, the 20th century, that, and it's still got the capitalism and poor people and things like that. Maybe all of the problems given a darker light for that. That'd be kind of fun, I reckon. The idea of when you're looking, we're talking about these others, these noble savages and such, but we think kind of people who lack technology or who are a little barbaric. But what Lyle just said there about maybe the Americans or the Canadians, just imagine that the Western world being stuck where it is currently with all of the problems that it does have, and then some other part of the world or other society that's advanced beyond those, and how they would look back at us.
I suppose. I think maybe at least for me, sort of the idea of early science fiction is, yeah, there's all this kind of, when we look at it now, it's kind of very one-sided and maybe arrogant. But at the time it was written, it sort of wasn't seen that way. And to do what you're suggesting, which could be fun, I think the characters would have to be from that sort of advanced society or that advanced country, whatever it was. And sort of there doing the good of essentially like Prometheus bringing fire to the unwashed masses. Essentially, they got to share the tech, share their ideology, and make the rest of the world better. Because I think maybe it's being optimistic, but I think that's what most of the early science fiction kind of saw itself as doing.
I agree, absolutely. I think so. That'd probably be the best way of looking at it, too. Especially for people like us from America, from Canada, who have these Western ideals, to look at someone who would look upon those.
Yeah, I don't think we could imagine it.
Hmm.
I think you could say, well, China could surpass us economically, but then we would always think, oh, but they're a communist country, they oppress the people. You know, we would hold on to that. But to imagine another country or civilization on the planet advancing both technologically and socially beyond us, I think would be very difficult. Maybe that's what we do in science fiction, is we imagine that it's another planet, an alien species. So, you know, in the invasion fiction, I think sometimes there would be, the invasion fiction was which was more mundane, maybe one country would have a, at least in the Battle of Dorking, they had a super weapon. But to imagine like them to be superior, like completely superior technologically, you just can't imagine it as another country.
Yeah.
You have to put them, give them, you know, they're from Mars now or something. Mm.
If you were going to do that, I think you would have to do an apocalypse first. You would have to set up some reason why the rest of the world is worse off than the country, you know, that you're from.
Well, if you take what Chris is saying, but you roll it back to the 19th century, and you, I mean, just so because it's easier for us to imagine, right. Imagine a 19th century Britain and a 20th century Japan, late 20th century Japan, and contrast that, you know, like all the technologies that Japan has, but they're part of the, at that time, the Yellow Pearl.
Mm, yeah.
Or, you know, a lesser race. They were the, but now you compare them and kind of say, like, Britain never really advanced beyond this stage. And now Japan kind of controls the world with its uber tech, which it only shares a little bit. There's a book called The Man in the High Castle, and we're kind of jumping around to scientific genres. This is Philip K. Dick. The Germans and the Japanese won World War II.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they split the United States. If you could just kind of imagine that, can you really wrap your head around that? Yeah.
I think I agree with Wayne a little bit, though. I think a lot of the themes that would come with an invasion-type story would be very similar to an apocalyptic-type story.
Well, I wasn't talking about an invasion-type story. I was working with what you were saying. If you had, like, existing on Earth, you had to a very advanced society that was not white and was not descended from Europeans. Mm. Yeah, you could do that. I think you'd have to, like, kind of stop the Europeans at around, the 19th century or early 20th century, in contrast to something that's late 20th century or early 21st century.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a really cool example, too. So going back a little bit to where we were talking about, like with Ming the Merciless as the other, you know, these authors, they were writing, they were writing for white European males. So it was really easy to portray the other as kind of these savages from around the world, the Mongol hordes or the Russians or something like that. But would that be more difficult to do in the modern day where, you know, everyone is so much more worldly? I mean, here we are, three white guys living in Japan.
Well, if you did like a modern day, I think that's exactly why it would have to be an alien race. I don't really think you could do modern day early science fiction for, which sounds really odd.
I don't know, for the exact same reasons, but I think to really capture the flavor of scientific romance, you have to ground some things in the time period that it's written. And maybe it's the social mentality, or maybe it's kind of the steampunk-esque type technology. But I think that's when you get the most out of the themes you want to explore. Yeah, but if you'd advance it now, we're kind of, if somebody's against gay marriage, that's kind of strange. Mm. You know, contrast that to when homosexuality was illegal.
Right.
Or that you don't blink if there's a female prime minister or president of a country.
Mm. Good example, yeah.
Yeah. If you were to do, like, if you were to bring up the social norms to now, then I think you have to roll back something else.
Mm.
Like, maybe it's rolling back the cynicism. And, you know, by the way, this is not a very peppy podcast. We're kind of being negative about what people probably thought was, hey, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah,
racist.
Yeah. But I think you hit the nail on the head with that idea of rolling back the cynicism. Because for us, modern, you know, people looking at these works, it's kind of hard to not see, for lack of a better term, how politically incorrect they were, or had at least had the potential to be. But for the time they were written, they were great. They were optimistic. They were kind of the way the world should work. And as you said, maybe rolling back that cynicism would allow you to do a modern day early science fiction kind of game. I still think it would be kind of difficult. And I think I'm more of the opinion with you, Lyle, where I think to do a lot of the themes we're discussing, or the themes that are found in this book, you would kind of have to do a very similar time period setting in your game.
You know, another thing to look at with that is not only the things that we would find surprising, but the things that people of that era find surprising. I never actually read the story, but I saw the film Metropolis, and after we watched the film, it was in film school, the teacher was talking about, at the time, people were really shocked because the robot in the end is female, and that was just kind of the leader being a female. That was something unheard of at the time.
Oh, fair enough. I kind of thought they were shocked just because there was a robot, but...
Well, yeah, that was part of it, too, but...
Yeah, but imagine that, and you'd be going, why would you pick a female robot?
Because it's sexy.
Well, nowadays, that's what we would assume, but yeah.
I've watched the movie, and it was essentially an android, a silver android, you know?
Yeah. But why female? Yeah, you can see people coming out of the theater. I don't get it. You know, why was that female? But nowadays, we might just like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm, yeah.
What were they saying? What does that mean? And finally, the last double barrel theme is evolution and innovation. And we talked about that with the devolving. But yeah, there's a lot of things that, especially Jules Verne predicted. Like we just mentioned 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and the tech of that submarine is very similar to a lot of other submarines. It's actually a little bit better in some respects. In fact, it could dive into any depth without being crushed. Yeah.
Is that perhaps because they didn't understand pressure at the time?
Oh, I think they dove. I don't know.
It's kind of like the science fiction stories where it's like, yeah, the air just keeps on going. We can fly all the way to Mars. You're like, you kind of can't really do that, you know?
Paddle through the ether.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's the Island of Dr. Moreau, which we talked about in our animals episode, where there's an experiment of using David Brin's word of uplifting these animals.
Well, I think the Isle of Dr. Moreau is a great example because at the time, the idea of evolution was still a fairly new concept. I mean, H.G. Wells was a student of Huxley. People didn't really have a grasp on what it meant, and there wasn't really a limit to what evolution could be or could do. You know, as far as people knew, animals, at least as far as common people knew, animals could evolve directly into people within a generation or two. So you could have these half-man, half-beasts. Good thing to play with.
Yeah, which I think kind of ties into that rolling back of the cynicism. Between like evolution and innovation of technology, you kind of take out all the stops that we now have in modern society or modern technology. When I read these stories, I always think it was almost a much more, maybe not much more, but it was kind of like a more innocent time, at least with technology and evolution and these like innovation, because you hadn't hit those limits. You could just kind of extrapolate kind of on to almost whatever you wanted. Now we kind of find out, yeah, time travel is probably impossible.
Yeah, but I understand what you're saying, and you're right. But when you read these novels, though, it's amazing how much they haven't dated. So when you read The Island of Dr. Moreau, even though you realize that you can't just like surgically
splice three cats together and have a cat man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just grow his little cat arms. Yeah.
Well, I wonder. I really hope that kids don't read Dr. Moreau and start like cutting on their cat because they want to. A cat friend. That'd be pretty
creepy.
It's
really hard to understand what he actually does to do it. Like, so I don't think they get that. But a lot of it was it's a social conditioning in going back to politics and society. But it is social conditioning. He's conditioning them, and this is I guess the white man's burden idea or the colonialism. He's conditioning them to be men and people, just like the white man would condition a savage to be more civilized.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, but that aside, or you read the Invisible Man, and you know, he doesn't really explain what chemicals he uses to become invisible, but he could certainly put himself into the problems of being invisible. Like, you know, I don't know if that's real terribly scientific, but you're like, yeah, standing out in the rain, you can see him. You know, sometimes you think about somebody like 100 years ago, and it's like as if they're a moron, and you read the book, and you're like, yeah, I guess that would be a problem being invisible, but. Oh, good job, H.G. Wells, for thinking of that. You know, it's just like, you simple 19th century man.
Yeah, it's like you were saying before with H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. Verne explained what went on in this technology, and that was a large basis for his story. But Wells didn't narrow that much. He said, here's the technology, but more important is, here's the effects of it. Here's what happens.
Yeah, so he took like evolution and went a different way, whereas Verne, like that scientific concept of evolution, Verne would look at the innovations like and see, well, what else can we do? What would be the next step?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like what do you predict? High-speed trains,
the internet,
automobiles, the internet, calculators, yeah. Skyscrapers.
Giants, skyscrapers, yeah.
Sorry, giants? Do you predict giants?
Yes. No, I was going to say giant buildings made of steel and glass, but yeah, you said skyscrapers.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, if you take evolution or that, what, like 1900s ladies home journal thing, hey, people are going to keep growing. He predicted giants.
They predicted they grow 2 inches.
Oh, all right. You didn't give me the full story.
I'm huge.
2 inches. You didn't say that they, like, all right, am I? I'm wrong. Back to zero, fine.
Of course, this is the jetpacks. Yeah, I guess we have those.
They were. Yeah.
Flying cars, yeah.
Don't we have those? I think we have a flying car.
Underwater cities.
Yeah, we do have underwater hotels.
Yeah, yeah. And not to correct you, Wayne, but we have a theoretical time travel, too.
Theoretical. I want to be able to sit in a chair and go see those Morlocks and those giant crabs at the end of the and at the end of time.
You know what's a good movie for scientific romance? The Prestige.
I'm waiting for the explanation.
Hey, have you seen The Prestige?
No.
How many times have I recommended that?
I don't know, probably a lot.
Yeah. Hugh Jackman, Christian Bale, a Christopher Nolan film, and they play two magicians, stage magicians. And, well, I don't want to ruin it.
Okay.
Maybe I shouldn't have brought it up at all.
Sorry.
That's a very good movie. Very dark, too. I like it.
Yeah.
Screw you, Wayne. Watch that movie.
And no, but you should watch it, and then you'll see some good examples of how they use technology. And it kind of goes with Tesla.
Mm.
So he's in the movie as well. Mm-hmm. And they considered him a bit of a genius.
Bit of a genius.
Yeah. As soon as I said that, like, look at me, 21st century man, being so condescending.
Yeah, let's see the Lyle coil you invented. Glad somebody laughed on that.
And of course, you know, as far as gaming goes, don't forget steampunk, the entire genre of it. I don't know of any outright systems for it. The one I'm using Savage Worlds for the one I'm playing, but
GURPS had the like steampunk. They even had a screampunk supplement.
Yeah, I think I saw that, yeah.
No. Castle Falkenstein?
Oh, yeah. Hey, good call.
I was going to say, one of the review copies we got through DriveThruRPG was Leagues of Adventure from Triple Ace Games, which uses the Ubiquity system. And it's essentially Victorian-era Hollow Earth Expedition. You know, it's like 1890s. And they have, you know, weird science in there, which is steampunk. I thought it was a pretty good resource for doing this episode. The book didn't excite me as much as I thought it would, mostly because it's almost exactly the same as Hollow Earth Expedition, just with a slightly different setting. So.
Now you're saying that, I just flashed to Call of Cthulhu and thinking about incorporating some scientific romance or romantic concepts into that. So instead of just the 1890s investigators, it's like your Jules Verne protagonist.
Versus Cthulhu.
Versus Cthulhu, yeah. Nemo versus Cthulhu.
Wouldn't it be Nemo versus Dagon? The water guy?
No, because have you ever read Call of Cthulhu?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in the water.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Remember how he got... Remember what happened there?
I remember. Yeah. I remember. Some things I have read. It sounds interesting. I'm wondering if you could do it, because, like I said, for me, kind of the early science fiction was very optimistic. Not exclusively.
You want to hear how you do that? Is the cults are all like, kind of like the Morlocks, or just your servants, or you're in colonial India.
Oh, I certainly thought about that a little bit, because it kind of goes back to that Lovecraft episode we did, where we talked about how you wouldn't really be able to tell if this person was just kind of, you know, an outsider, but still a human.
Ooh.
Or sort of one of...
Keep talking.
But you wouldn't really be able to tell if they were human or one of these sort of Cthulhu-esque creatures.
Yeah, you blew my mind, Lyle. That sounds like a totally awesome campaign. I can just imagine like the crew of the people from around the world in 80 days, but they're actually hunting elder gods.
Yeah, no, but prepare to have your mind blown even more. set it in the future, like this weird, crazy Jules Verneian future where the kind of the people have devolved. Remember, we're talking about like the Canadians, the Americans, and they branch out into two things. And then they go and explore, or you do your post-apocalyptic thing. They go and explore a ruined Europe on their fantabulous flying balloon machine. And they have all these like little Cthulhu cults in Europe, yeah.
Well, I could almost see it, rather than it being in the future, just like slightly alternate history and, you know, have...
Well, I don't mean our future.
Yeah.
I mean their future. From 1890s to like 1950 or 1990. I think, I guess what I'm trying to do with that mishmash of ideas, which I guess didn't blow your minds at all.
The first one did.
Guess I overreached.
Mine can only be blown once.
No, I'm still putting it back in the head.
Yeah.
I think a nice universal system is good, like GURPS, where you can really mix and match. Because what we're saying is like, you want to roll some things forward, but roll some things back. And a game that can, a system that can handle that is really good. I know we obviously don't talk about systems, but I think this is a case where you need to. Because, well, you could just be the H.G. Wells style and not have the tech, but you might want to do the Jules Verne and spend a little bit of time on that submarine or high-speed train. I guess you could get that anywhere there now.
Yeah.
A lot of systems can hit that one.
Or be in that balloon going around the world in 80 days.
I was thinking about the balloon, but I thought, God, that sounds lame.
Well, perhaps it could be
a dirigible.
Yeah. No. A much more awesome balloon.
I think that's important to have because as players, they're going to ask about the tech eventually.
That's when you say, you tell me.
Yeah.
Oh, that would totally suck playing in Fox's Grove version of Scientific Romance. So, what kind of tech do we have, guys? What, don't you have a plan? No, I'm going to ask you some questions.
Screw you. That's not my plan. That's not my plan to make that hack of that game.
We're going to sandbox the whole
thing. Oh, I think we found a system that Lyle hates even more than Savage Worlds. Who'd have thought that?
One game that I saw, I've read it, I haven't actually played it before. It was called Gaslamp Spectral, and it was a really dark twist on steampunk-ish, but it was very like this scientific romance. So if somebody's looking for something, that one's one to take a look at as well.
You know, it's out of print, but I really liked Buck Rogers 25. Yeah. And the reason why I just said that so slowly is because it's all the Roman numerals.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So XXV?
Yeah.
Again, I don't really like the system all that much, but I think Savage Worlds would be another one that would be okay when you're talking about, you know, sort of a universal system that you would want to be able to plug bits in based on what you rolled forward and what you rolled back. I think that would be another system that you could do it. Or Ubiquity would do the same thing, either through that Leagues of Adventure or Hollow Earth Expedition. It's easy enough to kind of, yeah, move something forwards and strip other things out. So I think that would work as well, too.
Savage Worlds worked pretty well for me in my campaign because of how easy the prep work is, because you got to make up a lot of stuff when you're doing science fiction. So it was nice to have a system with easy numbers that you could just plug in whatever you needed whenever you needed it. But then again, like I said, I'm a fan of Savage Worlds. So
that wraps up Scientific Romance, where we looked at the science fiction of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, and I guess we mentioned Sir Arthur Conan Doyle twice. So yeah. We could say science fiction as well. And Burroughs. So hopefully we gave you some ideas of what you can do in your game. Certainly didn't expect the episode to be this depressing.
especially since the work is so optimistic at the time.
Right. Hey, you want to roll back your cynicism. Maybe we should have rolled it back before we started recording.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Who would have thought that xenophobia, colonialism would be such a downer? Anyway, I think it would be a lot of fun. Certainly play with that time period, I think. You start from there, and the sky's the limit.
Mm.
Quite literally, because there's jetpacks.
Jetpacks. Yeah, I was going to say, because the air just keeps on going into outer space.
Cool. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, download it through Stitcher or off of DriveThruRPG or through iTunes. You can also post on our forums, follow us on Twitter, see us on Facebook, or just send us an email because we love from hearing all of you guys.
Yeah, and thank you again to No Clue, Temujin, and Jimbo Hawkins.
All right, see you all next time.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG. the one true source for RPGs.
Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.